Hi, I'm Conan Tobias, Editor-in-Chief of Tattle Creek. We are back once again at the Jet Fuel Coffee Shop in Toronto's Cabbage Town, in part because nobody else would have us, but mainly just because we like being here. It's one of our favorite places to launch. We're launching Tattle Creek number 46 today. This is it right here. For reasons that I'm sure everyone is sick of hearing at this point, there's once again no audience. We're here with a reduced crew of readers, and Derek Winshears has returned on the camera. And we're just going to do a few quick readings here on the Jet Fuel patio and throw to another contributor as well. We'll just get started right away. Our first author is Sam Shellstad. Sam is the author of story collection Cop House, and we've been trying to get him in the magazine for a while, and we finally got him this issue. We're happy to have him here. So please welcome Sam Shellstad.
Thank you, Conan. I'm going to read the story Cop House from the collection Cop House, or just part of it. It's the beginning. So here we go. I was cutting spider shapes out of a sheet of black vinyl when John Seabreeze called me up. I remember feeling so safe when he moved in next door. After Mom died, I was having these panic attacks. And then John moved in and I felt safe because he's a security guard. He works over at Pearson Airport. I was relieved because his whole career is protecting people. But then he started calling me at night and saying crazy things. He didn't even say hello this time. When the phone rang, I put down my scissors, picked up the cordless, and there was John cutting to the chase. "I want you to come over, Ruthie," he said. "I can't do that now," I said. "I want you to come over. We can play body games, Ruthie, please. Non-sexual, I promise." He was always talking about body games, which he described as a fully clothed, free-form touching and explorative play experience. He said they were good for the heart. "No, John," I said. "I've got the Halloween contest to work on. It's coming up." "You'll come over. I can see you, by the way." He hung up. He couldn't see me because I was in bed with the curtains shut, but that's what he did. He called me up, asked me to play body games, and then he'd tell me that he was watching me. The funny thing is that when I passed him on the street, he was normal, or quiet. Just mind his business, no mention of the calls. He had a brown mustache that looked exactly like his eyebrows, a third eyebrow above his lip. And I believed him when he said the games would be non-sexual, good exercise, and that even celebrities play them to unwind after the Oscars. But obviously it would be weird if I went over there. I really did have the contest to work on. When he called, I was lying in bed and cutting spiders out of a sheet of black vinyl for the spider cannon. Every year, my street has a Halloween decoration contest. Whoever has the best-looking house wins a bucket of candy from Costco. But really, it's more about the prestige. Last year, I didn't win. And the year before that, I didn't win. The year before that, my mom was still alive, and she won. And she won every other year since the contest began, too. I live in her house. I grew up here. I moved away, and then Mom died. Now I live here in Etobicoke again. Now, this year, I'm building a spider cannon, and I have all these special tricks planned, because I've got to win. I have this vision of my house decorated, and it looks okay. But then I pull a switch or something, and it's suddenly amazing. I'm not sure how to do it yet. Maybe there will be orange ribbons hanging from the eaves trough, but when I pull the end of a ribbon, all these yarn cobwebs fall down. I don't know. Then I can shoot off the cannon. At first, I thought I'd make the spiders out of paper so they'd float around a little before they hit the ground, but then I decided on vinyl because it would be easier to gather for reloading. I've got 2 weeks. Judging is on Devil's Night. I've got to win because Mom would have wanted it that way. She always won, but now that I'm here, it's Amanda P. from across the street who takes home the bucket. I grew up with her. We're both strawberry blondes. We both have freckles. I look like a taller, shabbier version of Amanda P. She's so pretty. She lives in her mom's house too, except her mom isn't dead. She's in a retirement home. Amanda P. is married and has been to Florida several times. She really went for it and carved out a nice life for herself. She doesn't have to work because her husband has a good job at the plastics plant. I hear him yelling all the time, but that's just blowing off steam from all the plastic he has to deal with. She's got it pretty good. She can stay home all day and work on her decorations. Last year, she had a 40-piece orchestra of carved pumpkins playing cardboard instruments. I'm full-time at Town Drugs, so I have to work that much harder when I'm off. I'm only sleeping 4 hours a night until the contest is over. But it'll be worth it when I take home the prize for Mom. You can only do so much in a day, though, so I finished cutting out a big Papa spider, turned off the light. Tomorrow, after work, I'll start thinking about the roof goblins, UFO mobile, coffin express train, etc., and how I might conceal these contraptions under a veil of mediocrity until judging. Thanks.
You can applaud. It's okay. You can applaud. Okay, go on. Yeah. Please applaud. Thanks, Sam. Our next author is Victoria Hetherington. Tori was one of the last people to read at Italic Creek Launch back when we were still able to have audiences. So we're very happy to have her back again today. She's the author of the novel, which I know the name of and have just forgotten, Moon Clouds, of course. And her next novel, Heartworms, is forthcoming in 2022. We're very happy to have her back again today. Please welcome Victoria Hetherington.
Thank you so much. One of my favorite comedians, Chris Fleming, said once that life is one long vacation when you're a massive fuck up. And I love that. And so I'm going to read to you guys a little bit from Moon Calves. I had to check as well. It's a weird name. That just sort of explores two total fuck-ups for whom life is one long, you know, really depressing vacation. So here we go. Here's the thing about being 32. Men expect you to be loving and straightforward, and when you're not, you catch them off guard. You're almost at an age at which they expect your gratitude. Almost, but not yet. Neil, all elbows and ears, is gripping the steering wheel of his mother's minivan. You were both high on mushrooms. He drives very slowly and keeps glancing over at you as you reapply eyeliner in the passenger's seat. Erica, Jesus, he says. I'm freaked you're going to poke out your eye. And you giggle. His profile appears dark against the winter white windshield. You watch him closely in your compact mirror. The first time I drove you home, I almost steered the car right off the highway and down into the water, he says. Like I could and should die, because I was so happy and I knew I'd never be happier. I'm glad that you didn't, you say, pulling the mirror back, as if trying to see your whole face, pretending like it doesn't occur to you that he might yank the wheel to the left, hard, or that he's considering doing it right now. Here's the thing about being 32. You still look 20-something, but there's something about your face that's like a cut flower in a vase, bright enough, vibrant even, but holding its breath. At least just stay with us, he's saying, or like, how much money do you need? He pulls up at the apartment building. The kitchen windows of the apartment you share with Sheila are dark. You lean halfway out of the car and feel for a dry spot on the sidewalk with the toe of your boot and then crane back to examine Neil's face. You're so high that the blood rushes to your head, carbonated. You blink and your inner eyelids burst white, yellow, and gold. That's really sweet, but I don't need your money. Oh, don't be proud, he says. Is Sheila just paying for everything? I swear to fucking God, the last time I heard you talk about work, there were leaves on the trees. Am I your child? No? Then it's not your problem. At the mention of his child, he winces, and you lean into him, squeeze his arm, rub his elbow with your thumb almost automatically. At 32, you've had 2 decades of practice. Though he's still frowning, his face goes a little slack and tilts expectantly. You kiss. Very stoned, you reach out and pull at his lip. Pinch it between your fingers. Reflect on how elastic it is. His red eyes skitter over you, likely pinging with thoughts of his own about your mouth, your eyes, your chin. You knew Neil at 20. He was generous with everything but money. He had none. He was all potential. You only remember him in springtime. He wanted to marry you one day because you loved each other, or because you were the first good fuck that he'd had. But really, it was because you took care of him by managing his romantic expectation of people to be good in love and of your spring to last forever until you didn't want to manage him anymore. You told him not to wait, knowing that living in the same big city, going to the same bars, which close down and then open up again under new management and fresh paint in the same buildings, and passing through the same gray, wizened snowbanks and fragrant cherry blossoms can all incur a state of waiting. Without knowing he was waiting, he waited and waited. You knew Neil at 30. too far into the track of being himself that it became a ditch, and he couldn't get himself out. He would do coke all night with his roommates, designing a board game that grew increasingly more complex until it became impossible to finish. His girlfriend was a woman at 20. When his roommate was busy, he stayed up all night alone, chain-smoking, gnashing his worn-down, yellowing teeth. 10 years ago, he'd been all Dewey promise, just as his girlfriend was. Neil, at 40, had freshly capped teeth, and is wholly defined by 33-year-old Neil, who, gawky and fecund, impregnated a woman down in Florida when half-heartedly road-tripping through his idea of the American South. They raised the child, a little boy, in a small apartment in the Everglades until the boy was about 7, at which time Neil turned 40, his girlfriend got a promotion and a new boyfriend, and Neil fled back to Canada, taking the boy with him, much to your annoyance. At 32, you don't know a thing about parental love, but Neil loves his boy Ryan like he's been set on fire. He calls you up and you spend an evening together, and then another, a string of humid late fall Toronto evenings. Black nights and beautiful autumn are still black, and once he tilted his body away from the weeping trees and announced that he felt young, younger than ever. Young, younger than you. Now he and his son live with his parents, and Neil at 40 might be just as much of a disaster as you are at 32. You haven't decided yet. Can you, he says, can you, come pick up Ryan with me? You rustle with annoyance. You only have a few good years left, you think? Just a few years left of not looking ridiculous at parties, in white sundresses, and you won't let anything tear you from carefully preened appearances at those parties, in those dresses. You rustle with annoyance, but you don't voice your dissent outright. You weren't raised that way. Your mother expressed hers through burning dinners, forgetting to buy things as asked, and implicitly taught you to do the same. Fine, you say, and take a long swig from a soggy McDonald's cup filled partly with Sprite and mostly with gin. Here's the thing about being 32. You can fill soft drink cups with hard liquor and get fucked up on Tuesday morning, just like you did at 15. Nobody will stop you. And this time around, nobody gives a shit. Now Neil is driving again, pausing at an empty four-way stop, squinting through the windshield. He then pulls into a big plaza parking lot, driving one-handed, his other hand submerged in a paper bag. The radio goes, 4:45, if you can believe it, and it's looking like freezing rain later tonight. Neil is now standing at the muddy edge of a ravine behind the plaza, dwarfed between two scrubby evergreen trees that seem ever so slightly in motion. You stand behind him. His hair and coat, the scattered and scrunched up plastic bags, and all the cigarette butts glow silver white in the December afternoon light. He looks back at you. You can just wait here if you want, he says. You give him an encouraging smile that you don't let, though you don't much like thinking about his son. The little boy makes you jealous. Neil is now halfway down the steep side of the ravine, bent forwards and clinging to a sapling, which arcs downhill towards him. You're climbing after him, taking tiny steps. The paper bag protrudes from his jacket pocket, and the suggestion of a not insubstantial structure of stacked tree limbs and stolen scrap metal edges the very bottom of the hill. He yells, "Hey guys, hey, is Ryan with you?" Two very young girls and an even younger boy poke their faces through a doorway in the structure, all straining to look up. The girls bear a striking resemblance to one another, and they can't be older than 12. One of them is smoking a cigarette. "Fuck you, Neil," one girl yells with a reedy voice. "He's a pussy," the other says. She's got a point, but you feel you should speak up. "Watch it," you say, and the girl gazes up at you with the cool indifference of a raccoon. Feral, oversized, and city-bound, with no natural predators. Neil kneels in the mud beside a tiny stream running through the lowest point of the ravine, 10 feet downhill from the fort, which viewed when stoned, is extremely impressive, and illuminated erratically from within by cigarettes and a flashlight. The young boy stands beside Neil, his mittened hands dangling by his sides. "Your daddy's crying," one of the girls observes, with the placid calm of a pigeon, glassy-eyed and conveying a perfect, plodding confidence, sealed airtight in an acorn brain. "No, I'm not," Neil says, and you feel nauseous with the insight that Neil's drug-filled need to see his child isn't so much about his child as it is about Neil and you. "You are crying. Don't lie to me," the kid insists, his cheek red. "I'm not a baby, and I'm not going to tell the girls anyway." Keep your voice down a little, okay, kiddo? Hey, I wanted to, this is Erica. You shift your weight from one foot to another. Your boot sinks into the silty mud. "Hey, Ryan," you say. "I've heard such lovely things about you." Ryan looks up at you, a sweet, open gaze. "Listen, buddy, I'm sorry we're not in Fort Lauderdale anymore, and I'm sorry I wasn't, like, as there for you when you were little, you know? And I'm sorry for all the things Mommy did when I wasn't around, and all the things I did when Mommy wasn't around." If you were standing close enough, you'd dig your heel into his foot, shutting him up like Neil, the kid's 7 years old. But you aren't, so you don't. "Did you know that once," Neil continues, "when you were strapped in your car seat, I poked you until you cried? I'm sorry I washed your budgie in the sink that time. You knew it was my fault it died, didn't you? I wasn't, feeling well that day." "I know," Ryan says. I think I'll stop there. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Tori. Brian Francis has been writing our Kitsch cooking column for the last 2.5 years now, I think. And he's got a piece in the new issue. His recipe is tomato soup cake, which you can not only read about and see in the new issue, you can also smell if you scratch the photo. It's a print exclusive. And he's going to just talk a bit about soup today from his home kitchen. So let's go over to Brian now. Take it away, Brian.
Hi there. My name is Brian Francis, and I write the column The Kitsch for Tattle Creek. In the new issue, I feature a recipe called tomato soup cake, which I know might be disturbing for some of you because the words tomato and soup and cake should never be part of the same phrase. But I'm assuring you that tomato soup cake tastes delicious. It got me thinking that maybe sometimes people don't think of soup in ways that it should be thought and about thought, and that's not really a word. But in any case, there are lots of uses for soup, just besides, you know, the usual opening the can, pouring in the water, and heating it up. So today I kind of just wanted to walk you through some of the different variations that you can use with your soup, just to kind of open up your world a bit. The first is, of course, the classic tomato soup. This obviously is a key ingredient in tomato soup cake, but my mom used to make a casserole that I used to love, which was tomato soup, ground beef, and you boil some macaroni, you throw it all together, sprinkle on a little bit of Kraft Parmesan cheese, and bake that for about 30 to 40 minutes, and you have probably the best casserole that I've ever tasted. I'm not even kidding about that. The next classic, of course, is cream of mushroom soup. This is a staple in your classic tuna noodle casserole, for example. It's one of the mainstays of many casseroles. And at the end of the day, just take a can of this, throw in some ground meat, some ground turkey, some Beyond Beef if you want as well. Throw in some noodles and you've got yourself a hearty and, well, maybe not so healthy dinner. If you're having company over, I recommend maybe taking it up a notch and using cream of celery soup if you want to be a little bit Martha Stewartson. You can also use cream of broccoli as well. And then, of course, there is cheddar soup, cheddar cheese soup. Actually, it's called cream of cheddar, according to the no-name label. My aunt used to make a casserole with this that involved ground beef, mixing it in with a can of cream of cheddar soup. You put French fries on top and you bake that, and then you have a cheeseburger casserole. And I don't think I need to sell you on it any more than just the name alone. This is vegetable soup. You can't make anything with this. I've never seen a recipe that called for a can of vegetable soup. So the only thing you can really do with this is just heat it up and eat it. Lastly, I did not want to forget about the always popular dried soup, specifically onion soup mix. Obviously, you can add this to a pot roast, add a bit of flavor, or to your hamburgers. But one of my favorite things is to take a package of Lipton onion soup mix, take a container of sour cream, mix it all in there, and you need to let this sit overnight. Don't mix it and then use it immediately. So let it sit overnight in the fridge so that those flavors tend to meld and the dehydrated onions get all kind of soft again. And what you end up having is one of the best chip dips that you could possibly ask for. Make sure you have a chip bowl on hand as well. And there you've got it, a little bit of heaven right there. With some onion soup mix and some sour cream. So I hope I might have changed your mind about how you can use soups in your life, and enjoy the rest of the launch, and I hope you have a super day.
Thanks, Brian. Our next author today is Michael LaPointe. Michael's debut novel, The Creep, is going to be launched in 2021. He's making his Tattle Creek debut this issue. Please welcome Michael LaPointe.
Hi, I'm just going to read a section from my novel, The Creep, which will be published by Random House in June. All you need to know is that it's narrated by a journalist named Whitney. The men I dated always described a certain limit in me, a check against intimacy. I think Keith was the last one I let in. After that, I contained a wall that no one ever scaled. I'd met Keith on campus when I was a freshman at USC. He was wheat-pasting posters for a show his band was playing, and I caught his eye. It's not that I'm unattractive, though my style back then was unspeakably bad, but I remember feeling confused about what drew him to me. It would take time to realize that what enticed him wasn't beauty. Keith had the unnaturally green eyes I'd come to believe from various movies and books to be portals into extrasensory dimensions, and he spoke with an ease present in the moment, foreign to my horny male peers. I went to his show that night at Small's KO and passionately admired how he became lost in the songs, which weren't any good, his flat, hairless stomach thrusting against the keys. We started seeing each other every day at his apartment in West Hollywood. I wasn't a virgin when I met him, but he made me realize I'd been having pretty indifferent sex. He set about learning my body with an intent that I thought sweet and would make me come again and again, almost against my will. It was the first time sex surpassed the pleasure of masturbation. After that night at Small's, I didn't go to his shows anymore. Keith was really trying to make it as a musician. What kind, he didn't seem to care. And so his bands were often just groups of strangers assembled by some semi-connected impresario trying to turn a buck. He kept a Sony Handycam in his apartment and would film audition tapes of himself playing one instrument or another. Things started going badly after those first sex comatose weeks. For one thing, we were always, always high. As soon as I walked in the door, before anything else, Keith would spark a joint. And when we woke up in the morning, he'd light one and watch me smoke it before class, as if it were my vitamins. Soon, he was bringing back coke from the shows. We stayed all up all night with it, and I'd have to give him endless blowjobs just to get him hard enough to fuck. Around this time, I started wondering exactly how old Keith was. I guess part of the rock and roll fantasy is that your talent gets discovered a little before, not a little after, it's flowering. So I understood why he was sensitive about his age. But after a certain point, it seemed like he was actually hiding it. And he was. I snuck a look at his driver's license while he slept, only to discover that the man lazing there in the early morning, burnt out on cocaine, dried semen on his leg, was twice my age. Soon we were fighting all the time. I tried breaking up with him, but he always found a way to talk me back, to turn my resolve into mere confusion. By the time we got done fighting, I was often too stoned and exhausted to go home. His bed would swallow me in cotton folds. Over time, the fighting also ceased to be exciting. Finally, I told Keith I was leaving for real. That's when he smiled, as if his face were slowly unzipping, and brought out the videotape. "Before you make up your mind," he said, "you should know about this." I think I already sensed what was on it. But I let him slide the tape into the VCR and saw myself snort a line off the bedside table and spread my ass for him. I watched as he shot cum on my back. I still feel sick when I recall the delirious sound of my orgasm. It's horrible to admit, but these are the only permanent images I have of myself in the act of sex. Keith had copies. He told me that, almost offhand. Not a single choice occurred to me. With the tape, he'd simply outmaneuvered me. So I stayed. I did the drugs. I took him in my body. Those are pitch black weeks. I remember feeling like a skull staring out through plastic skin and sensed, with indifference, that this was the precondition of a suicide. I was 19 years old. As the weeks wore on, Keith started drinking with even more rock star exaggeration. Maybe the remnant of his conscience was afflicting him, I don't know. One time, blacked out, he sleepwalked and took a piss in his acoustic guitar. I awoke to the sound of urine singing off the spruce. In the morning, he sat down to strum something, and it sloshed out the hole. Then there came a night when I stayed on campus until the facilities closed, trying to finish an assignment due the next day. The deadline had already been extended. In fact, the prof had taken me aside, and I thought he might ask how I was doing, if something was wrong. The story was right there, ready for his merest inquiry. But all he did was tell me that if I couldn't wrap my head around the concept of a deadline, I had no future in journalism. It was past 2 by the time I got to Keith's place in Hollywood. He didn't answer the buzzer, but someone at the lobby payphone recognized me and let me in. The blood-red light of an exit sign filled the hallway, where I found the door to Keith's apartment ajar. Keys dangled from the lock. My first thought was I was going to find him with another girl. I wasn't sure how I'd react. I thought I'd probably just sit on the couch and wait for them to finish. But Keith was sprawled in bed, alone, still wearing his clothes. The standing lamp had toppled. All the shadows were misplaced. Yellow vomit covered his shirt, down to his crotch. It smelled of beer. I could see pepperoni. I thought maybe he'd died a dumb rock and roll death, but then I saw he was breathing. There was no relief when I realized this. It struck me powerfully that his death wouldn't have been shocking or unwelcome. He meant nothing to me. All this meant nothing. I crouched beside him, observing, and saw the chunks blocking his nostrils. I didn't pick them out. I left him in bed, not closing the door behind me, and caught the bus home. I lived in a daze for weeks, hair coming out in the shower, but never heard from Keith again. Still, just his presence in Los Angeles, the existence of the tape, helped convince me to take the internship in Seattle after graduation. Even with the distance, it took a long time for the feeling to fade that he was watching me on a permanent loop. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Well, that's it. We couldn't have had a better day for this today. It's unusually warm for this time of year. So thanks, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to Michael, Tori, and Sam. Thanks to Derek for filming right again. Derek wanted me to tell everyone to smash the subscribe button, as the kids say. He says, on the internet. Thanks to Johnny and the Jet Fuel for having us both today and for the past 20 years here. This is the new issue. It might be in your mailbox already if you subscribe, if you've smashed the subscribe button in the past, or if you're near a bookstore that is open. Magazines are getting out eventually. Keep an eye out for it. Hey, to end on a sad note, but I just wanted to say quickly, we lost a member of our Tattle Creek family recently. R.M. Vaughn contributed to Tattle Creek for 20 years, and he died in October. And just wanted to say thank you, Richard. You're missed by a great number of people. So hopefully by summer we'll be able to do this with an audience again. Who knows? If not, we'll be back here probably doing this again. So thanks for watching.